For joining Class 10th on COVID-19 in the Office of CMS Administrator Seema Verma. Today we are joined by CMS leaders as well as providers in the field who have offered to share best practices with you all. First, I'd like to turn it over to Jean Moody Williams from the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality for an update from the agency. Jean, over to you.
Great. Thanks so much, and thank you all for being on the call. I always acknowledge that I know you're taking time away from your work to attend and hear the latest, and we greatly appreciate this, as we do believe and hope that it is helping to support you in the work that you do. So yesterday, CMS released the third interim final rule as a part of our efforts to combat COVID-19. If you've had the opportunity to read through the rule, hopefully, I know it was just released yesterday, but you will notice that the primary theme of the new regulations is really to achieve the goal of increasing the testing of nursing home residents and staff and the reporting of test results and other COVID-19 data elements. This testing and reporting is really vital to helping to win the battle against COVID-19 and protecting the health and well-being of Americans, especially the most vulnerable among us in our nursing homes. So while we have provided testing guidelines in the past, we're now mandating regular testing of both residents and staff for COVID-19 as a requirement for participation in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. The rule requires testing based on parameters identified by the secretary. Today, in support of the interim final rule, we just released guidance that will provide details on how to meet the new testing requirements, including how to conduct testing when there's someone who has COVID-19 symptoms, someone that tests positive, and conducting routine staff testing based on the county positivity rate. So the guidelines are very detailed, and it would take this entire call to walk through them line by line. But it does define, and we took into consideration some of the questions that we've received from you in our prior guidances related to testing. We talk about what it means, what we mean by staff, such as employees, consultants, contractors, volunteers, and caregivers who provide care and services to residents on behalf of the facility. It also includes information on prioritizing, and this is important, we want to prioritize individuals who need to be tested. So we noted that facilities should prioritize individuals with signs and symptoms of COVID-19 first, and then also those in an outbreak situation should be tested. And then we do give guidance for routine testing as well. Routine testing should be based on the extent of the virus in the community. Therefore, facilities should use their county positivity rate in the prior week as the trigger for staff testing frequency. Now, the reports of the COVID-19 county-level positivity rates will be made available on a website that is listed in the guidance, and it will be available beginning on August 28th, you should be able to find this data. When making a decision about testing, you have to look at the county positivity rates to determine the frequency, and if it is less than 5%, then the frequency would be once a month, from 5% to 10% once a week, and greater than 10% twice a week. State and local officials may also direct facilities to monitor other factors that increase the risk for COVID-19 transmission, such as the rate of emergency department visits of individuals with COVID-19-like symptoms. So you have to look at the county rate and then other factors that might be important. Facilities that do not comply with the testing requirements will be cited for noncompliance at the condition level, and additional enforcement remedies, such as civil monetary penalties, will be imposed based on resident outcomes. So you look at the scope, the severity of the noncompliance, as we do in many other cases, and listed in Chapter 7 of the State Operations Manual. Now, we do recognize that challenges exist, and sometimes with performing routine testing, and when a facility is unsuccessful in meeting the guidelines, surveyors will consider documentation that demonstrates the facility's attempt to perform and or obtain testing in accordance with the guidance, looking at timely contacting state officials, multiple attempts to identify a lab that can provide testing within 48 hours. All of those things become important. We are also continuing, in addition, we want to be able to enhance our ability to monitor compliance outside of just surveying. So we're looking at automated methods for determining compliance with availability of data. We also announced that we want to make this required testing as easy and as less costly for nursing homes as possible by providing point-of-care testing devices and test kits to every one of the nation's over 15,000 Medicare and Medicaid certified nursing homes if you have received a CLIA waiver to conduct low-complexity testing. And we've announced several times, almost weekly, when we first started on this call, the importance of seeking to get that CLIA waiver, and that information is readily available from CMS on our website. And I also wanted to note that the point of care testing devices are appropriate for surveillance purposes, and that I think it was yesterday or the day before, the FDA actually issued an FAQ that indicates that antigen tests can be used for surveillance purposes in congregate care settings like nursing homes. If there's an outbreak or high clinical suspicion of an infection in an individual resident, if they have symptoms, for example, a negative point-of-care test should be confirmed with a highly sensitive molecular test. And you can refer to the CDC guidelines for more information on that. It's not necessary to perform confirmatory high-sensitivity molecular tests on individuals with a negative antigen test or other points of care test results if they are obtained just during your routine screening or surveillance and there is no reason, there's no outbreak, there's no symptoms, etc. Additionally, we'll be helping facilities offset some of the costs of testing through, this would be for your staff related, funding through the Provider Relief Fund. And you'll hear more about that later, I believe this week or next. Specifically, nursing homes will receive $2.5 billion in testing for testing as well as for other areas that might be needed. So the last point I really wanted to mention is the CLIA laboratory reporting. The CARES Act requires all labs performing testing related to SARS-CoV-2 to report data daily for all individuals tested, and this is reported to the appropriate state or local public health departments as required by the local law or policy within 24 hours of results. There's guidance that we released today in one of our memorandums that also will point you to the HHS guidance on how to report this information. And I know that our colleagues at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as others, will be ensuring that you get information that you need to help you with this reporting. And we're all working together with that. And if so, because we want to ensure that you are reporting, because there are CMPs that are attached to this, but we have also noted a grace period of 3 weeks to allow for the ability to learn what needs to be done and how to report. And I already know that some of you are already doing the reporting, but some are not. The IFC does talk about some hospital reporting requirements as well, but I won't go into those. And there's some other provisions that are in there that you probably want to take a look at. We do talk about the SNF value-based purchasing program, and due to statutory requirements to use a single readmission measure for determining SNF payments, we are changing the performance period for FY 22 program year from October 1st, 2019 through September 30th, 2020. Of course, 6 months of that includes the 12 months that have, is 6 months of that covers some of the wage period. So the performance period will be April 1st, 2019 through September 30, 2020, so that we can have reliable information. So we're moving it back from October to April. Finally, we did announce training on yesterday, unprecedented national nursing home training program for nursing home staff, frontline workers. We have information for those workers as well as management. And it's been designed with your input, input from the CDC and others. From within, I think, 24 hours of announcing it, we've already had 3,000 nursing homes sign up for it and several hundred completed already. So please go in and take a look at that. So a lot of information, a lot going on. I'm going to stop there because I want to give a few minutes to our great guest speaker so we can hear from the front line, and then we'll save some time at the end for questions for either what I just spoke about or from our guest speaker, Ms. Pamela Dozier, who's the Executive Director of Dogwood Village of Orange County. So let me turn to you, Pam.
Thank you very much. I've been asked to speak about things that we've been doing at our facility to prevent COVID. And we are still COVID-free, which I'm very proud of. We have performed surveillance testings, and everybody came out negative. That was staff and residents. So we started out with locking down our facility before anybody else did, and I think that kind of helped us get a head start. We currently request that all residents stay in their rooms as much as possible, and if they do come out, they must wear a mask. One of the challenges has been with our dementia residents because they consistently will pull the mask off or pull it down under their nose or under their chin. And we have talked to our staff about being consistent with them. And now our dementia residents are, in fact, wearing their masks appropriately. We do have some residents that, for safety reasons and fall prevention, we keep in our day room area. Because of that, we have developed a screen that we put around the residents. And this screen is merely a clothing rack that folds into kind of an L shape. And we put clear shower curtains on the clothing rack so that we can still see the resident, but they are protected from other residents walking up to them or rolling up to them should they not have a mask on. And we have found it to be very effective. At first, some of the residents were a little distressed about it because they were like, I've got to be able to see you. I've got to be able to see you. And we very clearly showed them that they could see through the shower curtains and that it was okay and made them feel secure and comfortable. We do have a cleaning process in place for the shower curtains that they are cleaned after every use so that there's no contamination left on them and put around another person. So if they're moved from one person to the other, they are cleaned consistently between them. We have scheduled window visits with the families. We have two designated areas for the families to come. and have window visits with their loved ones. We do schedule that so that it's not several people all at once lining up to see their loved one. We also do FaceTime and Zoom meetings, and I'm sure a lot of the facilities that are on this call do some of the same things. We have created an observation unit for all new admissions, and they are on that unit for 14 days. We have applied zipper doors to the doors on the observation unit so that should someone become symptomatic, then we can zipper the door closed and still leave the door open for visual reasons and safety. We have also put a zipper door at the end of the hallway to block off access into the kitchen area, because our dining services is right in the middle of our building, and so we had to figure out some way to block off this unit so that the kitchen would still be considered in the clean zone and a safe zone. So we put a zipper door there as well. All of our admissions come into the entrance on that particular unit, so they are not being taken throughout the building. We do require that they request that they get a negative COVID test prior to coming to us from the hospital, and the hospitals have been doing that automatically. We've not had any issues with that at all. We do request that there be minimal external appointments, so that if a resident has to go out to the doctor, we determine with our medical director and our nurse practitioner whether it's an absolute necessary appointment or if it's something that could be rescheduled for later, like potentially just an annual dermatology inspection or teeth cleaning or something like that. If someone does need to go out to an appointment, we arrange transportation through the transportation service, who only takes one person at a time, and they clean extensively in between each patient that they transport. And we have, in fact, observed them doing that with whenever they drop somebody off or pick somebody up from our facility. We do have our dialysis patients going out. We have talked to our dialysis center that services these residents, and they have put in place the social distancing, the physical distancing, and they require to wear their PPE during the whole time. When they go out, they wear a gown, gloves, mask, goggles, and then when they return, we remove all of that, and they are bathed, and their wheelchair, if they are in a wheelchair, the wheelchair is cleaned as well. So we're trying to limit any potential for contamination of anything. All our deliveries are made out, they are dropped off outside of the building in designated areas, and then we bring the goods into the building. If a vendor does need to come into the building, they are screened just like our staff are, and they must wear full PPE. And I think that's about all. Of course, we're promoting all the staff wear masks and wash their hands and physically distance. And the staff are screened every day when they come into work, and if they should leave the building at any time and return, then they are screened again.
So thank you so much for that great information, and particularly as we start to look at visitation guidelines, it's great to hear what you've been doing. It sounds like you have quite a number of avenues that you've been using to ensure safety, creative methods. And so we invite others to share your thoughts as well on creative methods of moving forward with visitation. So we have some time left for some questions, and I believe we have some of our subject matter experts from CMS on the line as well. So if we can open up the line, please, for questions for CMS or for our speaker. Thank you.
As a reminder to ask a question via telephone, please press star 1. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Doug Burr of Healthcare. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Doug Burr from Healthcare Navigator. And we work with several skilled nursing facilities across four southeastern states. And in looking at the list of roughly 13,000 facilities that CMS has issued indicating that they would have their point-of-care testing devices by the end of September, including all the nursing facilities from 10 states, that, and of those 10 states, it included the states of South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, and Florida, where we operate. I found that we had four of our skilled nursing facilities that were not included in that list and should be. How do we go about getting those facilities on the list so they will actually receive a testing device within the cohort that's supposed to receive them by September 30th?
Great. So, Evan, I'll let you handle that question.
Sure. Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for your continued work in these difficult times. I believe there is, on the website where we posted the information, I think that you should find an email address where you can send that information, where you can send the information about those facilities. And if not, by the end of this call, I'll try to get that email address, and I can announce it on this call. But essentially, the facilities should be able to get a CLIA certificate of waiver, and that should enable them to get those to be on the list. They do need to act quickly, though. But luckily, the certificate of waiver process is very quick. I'll chime in maybe a little bit later.
Well, these facilities already have their CLIA waivers, and Evan, I know how to get your email address as well. So if there isn't an email address on there, could I send you an email directly on these buildings?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Kathy Humblin. Your line is open.
Hi there. I was wondering, I know I heard your guest speaker talking about appointments and sending residents out in full PPE. My question is that something that surveyors are going to be looking at as to whether or not assisted livings and or skilled facilities place residents in isolation, transmission-based precautions when they go out for an appointment, as well as for emergency room visits?
So does anyone want to take that? I know we have our CDC colleagues on as well.
Well, this is Evan. I don't know if anyone else is on, but in the silence, I'll just say that, you know, we facilities should follow what's on the CDC website for transmission-based precautions. If someone has tested positive or someone is suspected of having COVID-19, and if not, then there's guidance on precautions that individuals should adhere to when leaving the facility, and that's what all facilities and surveyors should be following. Does that answer your question?
Well, I don't see anything specific in the CDC guidelines for what's considered unknown. So are we considering our homes a bubble? And once you go outside the bubble, then you are considered an unknown? Because CDC has guidelines on an unknown COVID, but they don't say that if you go to an appointment, or you go somewhere that's considered an unknown exposure, unknown COVID status.
I think it depends on the situation. Someone leaving the facility, for extended periods of time, the type of situation that they are in, it makes a difference. For example, there's a difference between someone who routinely goes for, say, dialysis versus someone who is, you know, maybe just going outside for a little bit. So I think that I don't think there is CDC guidance that considers them all as someone that needs to have transmission-based precautions applied to them, but I do think that there is guidance that suggests that you should consider observing them, again, based on the conditions that they were in when they left the facility. But I don't know if anyone from CDC has anything to answer, anything to add to that.
And just can I add that I know HCAM just recently submitted something that said people who go out for appointments are considered an unknown. And quote the CDC on that.
I'm sorry, what's HCAM?
It's Michigan's association. They had asked for some clarification. And so they talked to Licensing and Regulation in Michigan, who said that, yes, if a resident goes out for an appointment, then they are considered to need transmission-based precautions. And in today's, with the influenza coming up, how are we going to have enough PPE to be isolating every single person who goes in and out of the building without using any clinical observation? Everybody's being screened. We're using source control. So now we're going to be cited if we don't put someone in transmission-based precautions? I'm just questioning that.
What I suggest is, you know, if we haven't addressed it on this call and if it's not addressed on the CDC website, continue to monitor that website as things change. You know, maybe on a future call we can try to reference the areas on the CDC website that speak to individuals that leave the facility. But it's really going to be the best source for information related to this, and it's what both facilities and surveys should be following. If we need to make any specific directions to surveyors that are different, then we can do that from the CMS end.
Right, and we will relay this question on to the CDC as well. So thank you for bringing it up.
Thank you.
I think we have time for at least one more question, please.
Our next question comes from Shannon Gutman. Your line is open.
Hi. For the new mandated testing, is there a time frame for which we have to have it completed by for that first round until we can move on to the chart?
Jean, you want me to take that?
State that there's a clear reporting requirement that has to be done within 24 hours to report that. But then I think you're talking about the other requirements. So, Evan, I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that our testing recommendations and guidance on CDC website, a lot of it is not new, and many of you have been doing this for a while. So which we thank you for, and that's great. And it's only serving to help you and to help our nursing home residents. One of the things that Jean mentioned earlier in her remarks is part of the guidance that was released that talks about that a facility needs to document if they cannot meet the requirement today because of whether it's testing supplies or whether it's turnaround time from a lab, they need to document their attempts to fix that. So as long as facilities are doing their best to try to meet this requirement and have the documentation for doing that, then they will likely not be cited. But we do expect facilities to really do their best to try to meet this requirement. And for those that are doing it, really, you know, again, thank you for that and should have no problem continuing on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the question. Thanks, Evan. And thanks to all of you. I know as you have time to kind of digest the guidance because it was just put out, there will likely be more questions, and we are very happy to try and address it whatever, as I mentioned earlier, we can't address. We can connect with our colleagues at the CDC and even the FDA, as I mentioned. They have put out an FAQ, and it's important for me to say that what I mentioned about asymptomatic testing is by way of a frequently asked question, so that if you're looking for that kind of documentation, that's the form you'll find it in. So with that, I'll turn it back to Lena to kind of close it out.
Great. Thanks, Jean, and thanks, everyone, for joining our call today. Our next call will take place the second week of September. Can't believe we're already approaching September. In the meantime, you can continue to submit questions to our COVID-19 mailbox. And again, that's covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. As always, we really appreciate everything that you are doing for nursing home residents and their families around the country as we continue to address COVID-19 as a nation. This concludes today's call. Have a great rest of your day.